Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. The topic for this first hour of the show is campaign finance reform, something that we have discussed quite a bit on the show, but it's been a while, and we thought perhaps it'd be a good opportunity now to check in on the issue once again and talk about where things stand, what candidates have been saying, and some of the proposals for changing the way that we finance political campaigns. And we will have two guests with us on the program. We'll start with one, and then about midway through, we'll bring in the second guest. Our first guest here is Nick Neihardt. He is the executive director of a group called Public Campaign, which is based in Washington, D.C. It is a nonprofit and nonpartisan group which is interested in this particular issue. He is the co-founder of this organization as well as being the president executive director. It's been around for 3 years. He worked as Public Campaign's field director from 1997 to 98, and worked with reformers in the states of Arizona and Massachusetts who won full public financing ballot initiatives 2 years ago. And before that, he directed a six-state campaign finance organizing project for Northeast Action. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And perhaps I should mention that our other guest, William McNary, who is co-director of Citizen Action Illinois, which is this state's largest public interest organization, will also be joining us at probably about 10:30. So we'll bring him into the conversation at that point. And of course, as we talk with our two guests this morning, you folks who are listening are welcome to call in if you have questions, comments. Anybody who's listening can be a part of the conversation. All we ask of callers is you try to be brief, and we just ask that so we can keep things moving along, and we like to accommodate as many different people as possible. So you are certainly welcome to call 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You match the numbers on the phone with the letters, you get WILL. So that's another way to think about it, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Neihardt, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Sure.
We appreciate it. I want to maybe have you just talk a little bit about the subject as it's now being discussed on the national level by candidates. Certainly, this was an issue, particularly was an issue because John McCain decided to make it an issue during the primaries. Mr. Gore, Mr. Bush have talked about this. They have made proposals somewhat different. The vice president has talked about banning soft money and talked about providing either free or discounted broadcast time for candidates. Mr. Bush says he would like to ban soft money donations from labor unions and corporations. He also has says that he actually would favor raising personal contribution limits, but would be for using the internet to have disclosure, if not instantly, well, as soon as you possibly could. So they're talking about it, but it seems that it's not the issue is not as given as much attention or as prominent as during the primary.
Sure. I mean, I think there are a couple important things to note. One is that the issue as a whole is getting more attention in an election than it ever has before. And you mentioned that it's not quite the front burner it was in the primary. But on the other hand, this issue has never been a front burner issue. And just to see it mentioned in the presidential debates is a first. In fact, during the course of the campaign, the four leading candidates, Bush, McCain, Bradley, and Gore, all addressed this in one way or another. And I don't think that was at all true in 1996. Now, of course, the reason they're doing that is the numbers are going through the ceiling. There are all kinds of records are being set, both hard money records and soft money records. Big money is playing the largest role that it ever has in American elections. We're going to see something over $3 billion spent this year, which is a record. Now, it's interesting to look at the proposals that both candidates have thrown out there. Certainly McCain wanted a soft money ban. Gore's in agreement with that and said he wants to push that once he gets elected. But Al Gore is even going a step further than that, saying that what we need is a system of public financing under which candidates don't take private contributions. And that's the kind of system that we see support for at the state level. And in fact, states, as you mentioned, in Arizona and Massachusetts, states have begun to adopt these systems. A system like that is actually running in Maine also this year, mm-hmm. after the voters put it in. So the people are ready for change that goes much beyond what the candidates are talking about. The candidates are playing catch-up right now. There's widespread support for disclosure, but disclosure alone, because we have pretty good disclosure at the federal level, disclosure alone doesn't change the fact that candidates are forced to rely on big money contributors if they want to compete successfully and win. So we certainly need to go further than that. The important thing to remember about soft money, because I know that's been a big topic, is that it constitutes probably less than a fifth of the overall money in this election. So you can't reform politics just by going after the soft money. You need to deal with the hard money as well.
We can go on and talk just in a moment here about what's happened in the states that we've talked about, and maybe you can describe exactly how the systems they have there work. Just for a moment, the Supreme Court recently upheld the constitutionality of limiting individuals in their contributions. They said, as now is the case, there's a limit to how much you can give in any given election cycle.
That's right.
But they, at least so far, it seems that the court is holding to the Buckley decision, the one that perhaps everybody has heard about. This was the one that says, well, maybe you can place limits on how much an individual can contribute to a campaign. You cannot place limits on how much a candidate can spend.
That's right. There are some legal scholars who see in that decision that affirmed individual contribution limits. There are some legal thinkers who see in that an emerging core of Supreme Court support that might allow a Supreme Court decision sometime in the next few years, which would legalize overall aggregate spending limits. Now, that's just what some legal scholars see, and there isn't a majority there yet, but they think an opinion like that could be rendered over the next several years. But you're right. The Buckley decision allows some kinds of limits but not others, and the overall result is that there are no serious limits. No limits without loopholes, anyway, in the present campaign finance system.
Yeah, that's what I was. I have heard that same suggestion. Some people are saying, "Well, it's not impossible that the court might reconsider Buckley, but it may not be highly likely anytime soon, but not impossible."
That's right. I mean, I think you need to take a slightly longer view and realize that in the next 5 years, the composition of the court may change considerably, and that the judges appointed by either Bush or Gore may have different opinions than the current justices.
So here in the short run, when we're talking about reform, it seems that one is going to have to rely on the candidates voluntarily limiting their spending or voluntarily making decisions about how much money they're going to take and where it's going to come from.
That's right. And there's a lot of talk. For instance, in the second most publicized race in the country, I'd say, is the Clinton-Lazio race, which may be the first U.S. Senate race where over $100 million, when you total all the candidate spending and all the soft money expenditures and issue expenditures, maybe over $100 million. That would certainly set a record. In that race, they both agreed to a voluntary soft money ban, and we've seen that pledge really fall apart. Voluntary pledges by candidates just don't work. Either candidates make them when they're safe to make or politically opportune, or they make them in good faith, but in the end, if there's a decision between breaking the pledge or wiggling out of it, they'll make a decision about, does this cost me more votes or does spending the money gain me more votes? And it's a political decision. You need laws, enforceable laws, to govern candidate behavior. So the voluntary pledges don't mean much and won't change politics.
We have a caller here, and we'll get right to them because they're calling on a cell phone, so I promise I won't make them wait. Just long enough for me to reintroduce the guests we're talking with here. We're talking with Nick Neihardt. He's executive director of the group Public Campaign, which is based in Washington, and it's a national nonprofit organization interested in campaign finance reform. Also, we will be talking in maybe about 15 minutes with a second guest, and then we'll have both guests together, and that will be William McNary, who is co-director of Citizen Action Illinois. And then we'll talk a little bit about how this looks from the Illinois perspective. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's our caller on our line 4.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have two statements and one question. Has Governor Bush repudiated what he said early in the campaign that he would not not be in favor of campaign finance reform because it would hurt the conservative Republican cause? And then again, so that's one statement. And another statement is, my husband believes that Vice President Gore has not said that he is in favor of public financing. He used to be in favor of public financing of candidates. And then my last question is, could you describe in some detail the difference between soft money and hard money? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks
all
very
right.
much.
Well, shall I take all three of them?
Yeah, sure. To the extent that you can comment, particularly on the first two, whether
sure.
what you know of what Mr. Bush, Mr. Gore may or may not have said.
Right. On Bush, he certainly favors fairly limited reforms. Being in favor of disclosure, and on soft money, he supports banning union soft money contributions and corporate soft money contributions, but leaving the field wide open for individual soft money contributions. So, you know, it isn't really a serious limit, quite frankly. And Al Gore, in the debate, said for 24 years, or he began supporting public financing 24 years ago. So in the debate, he didn't say, and he still supports it, but if you look at his campaign platform, it includes what's called a democracy endowment, which is a publicly accessed fund that allows candidates to campaign without using private contributions in order to campaign. So he does still support public financing. Our question to him is, do you support it for the primaries as well? Because if you just let the private contributors pick the primary horses to ride and then reward them with public funding afterwards, you're still not getting at the heart of the problem. In terms of soft money versus hard money, essentially, it is almost the same kind of money. Technically, there are some differences. If in an ad you say vote for or vote against somebody, that ad has to be paid for by hard money contributions. If the ad says so-and-so is terrible or so-and-so is great, that ad can be paid for by soft money contributions that are then used for that issue ad. In actual fact, the ads look perfectly identical. So the real difference is soft money is basically unregulated and can be given in unlimited amounts by individuals or corporations or organizations like the NRA or labor unions. So it's the unlimited amounts, individuals too, that really set it apart. But when it comes down to how it affects elections, soft money right now is used for basically the same things. Originally, it was supposed to be special money set aside for party-building activities given to the parties, but the use goes far beyond that right now.
So just to understand what Governor Bush has said, he said that he would like to see a ban on soft money donations from labor unions and corporations and specifically, but would that I guess it still seems to me that it would be possible for bundling to occur, essentially, for those organizations to pool their resources and then just give it in one person's name.
That's right. I mean, we recently saw an example a year or two ago. Time Warner forswore, in a big public announcement, said, we're not going to make soft money contributions anymore. And then if you look at the FEC records, one of their lobbyists and some top executives all of a sudden turned around and were making individual soft money contributions, political contributions. So if you take away that whether it comes from a corporate treasury or not, it's the same decision makers running the same kinds of money into the same places. So it really isn't that different.
Well, I'm interested in hearing, and I think people listening probably would be interested in hearing something about what has happened now in a couple of states have passed laws that are that a lot of people see as good models, or at least something that we should look at, Maine and Vermont. And it may be a little bit different between those two places. But what's the basic idea of the reforms that have been implemented there?
If you want to look for sweeping reforms, you got to turn away from Washington. Even the reforms that are on the table that they're trying to pass are relatively small, a good first step. The sweeping changes that are going on sort of under the national radar screen are happening in the states. And there are a number of states where clean money style full public financing is on the table. In four states, they've actually passed it. In Arizona, Maine, and Vermont, the system has actually gone into effect, and there are 163 candidates running clean. It'll go into effect in Massachusetts, where it was passed 2-1 on a ballot initiative in 1998 in the 2002 cycle. So right now, these 164 candidates, more or less, the laws are a little different in each state, but the basic idea is this. You qualify for your public financing by gathering a large number of small contributions, $5 or $10, the number of contributions, and they come from people in your district. It depends on the size of the district. So you raise these $5 or $10 contributions from people in your district. You hit a qualifying threshold, and then you're given a flat sum of public money to campaign on. If your opponent, and you have to give two promises, it's very important, you agree to take no money, no other private money, and you agree to limit your spending to the money from the public fund. So you get a spending limit in there, you end the private money hunt that indebts candidates to contributors, and you're running, as they say in Maine, you're running clean. If your opponent plays by that same system, you have a level playing field. You each have the same amount of money, and it's a contest of ideas and people's community networks and grassroots savvy, but it's not a contest about money anymore because you have a level playing field. If your opponent doesn't take that deal and raises more money than you do, you get a match to keep you even up to a fixed amount. We can't bankrupt state treasuries with this program, but you get a match to keep you even up to a point where you've got a good shot of winning, even if your opponent winds up spending some more money than you. So that matching fund you dig into to keep pace is very important to maintain the level playing field and not put the publicly financed candidates, the clean money candidates, at a disadvantage. There's one other important thing. If you're attacked by soft money, if you're attacked by an independent expenditure, someone comes in and says, geez, you know, this guy Joe Jones is a terrible person, you get a matching funds to reply to that ad to get your word out so that you're not at a disadvantage there anywhere. Anyway, so that's the system in a nutshell. You get a level playing field, you get candidates who don't have access to money or don't want to be indebted to big private interests, they're allowed a level playing field to run on. So it's a good system for everybody.
You have another caller here to bring in. Let's do that in Urbana, line one. Hello.
I thought that Nebraska had a good plan, too. And now that you described Vermont and Massachusetts, I guess, they sound similar. Are they? I thought the fact that after you took public money, if you outspent your opponent with private money, again, in Nebraska, there was public money that would make the field even again. Am I right?
There's a Nebraska plan that I think may still be in effect. I think they may have also made some changes into it. But the basic idea was if you agree to a spending limit and your opponent doesn't, let's say it's $50,000 for your race, you agree to $50,000, you stop raising when you hit that, and your opponent doesn't make that agreement and raises more, then you get a public match that kicks in. The difference is that under the Nebraska plan, that first $50,000 still has to be raised from private sources, and that's a major difference. It does mean that to get the public financing, you first have to curry favor with the private contributors, and that's a step we'd like to avoid.
Uh-huh. Well, these others seem to have such merit, Vermont and Massachusetts, and is there any hope for spreading them? They have
yes,
to
yes. You should know that there are. We work with activists nationally in 40 states. For instance, in Connecticut, the lawmakers put a bill that included a clean money system for the race for governor and other statewide elected officials on the governor's desk. He vetoed it, but they came close. Other states, Wisconsin, North Carolina, have come close, and I know the next guest can speak to the progress that's being made in Illinois on passing a clean money type system.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Yes, and indeed, we will hear in a couple of minutes, we will be bringing in our second guest for the hour, William McNary, co-director of Citizen Action Illinois. So we'll find out a little bit about what's going on in Illinois. Maybe just for a moment or two here, I think that people are often say they're very unhappy with the tone of campaigns. They're unhappy with the way that they're conducted. And while they also may be unhappy with the way campaigns are financed, I think given that first thing that I said, that often people are unhappy with the tone of campaigns, the idea of public financing somehow bothers them. The idea that candidates will essentially take their money, take taxpayer money, and use it in ways that they might find unsavory. And for that reason, that seems to erode or eat into some of the support for public financing. How does one address a concern like that?
I mean, you're right, and I think people have to weigh the merits of the system against the cost. We would say that, you know, for $5 to $7 per taxpayer, if you can free candidates from the private contribution special interest money chase, that's a good deal. Some people don't agree with that. But when we've polled nationally, we found 65 to 70% support for this kind of public financing. The key is that the candidates get completely out of the private money chase. So if you just say, do you support public financing, the numbers might be around 50%. If you say public financing, but only for candidates who agree to spending limits and agree not to take private money, the support goes up significantly to that 65 to 70%. And I just say in the three states it's been on the ballot so far, the voters have approved it. So better than polling, let's look at what voters actually say when the system is put before them and they get to vote on it. In Massachusetts, for instance, it won by a 2-to-1 margin.
Hmm. And so in Maine and Vermont there where it has, and Arizona where it has been in effect, people still there seem to be positive about it. There hasn't
sure.
been any,
I mean,
any
we're
sort
still
of change.
Early. The system's just in its first cycle. But there seems to be satisfaction with the system. It's going through without glitches. And the most interesting thing is to talk to the candidates who have chosen, about a third of them now, have chosen to run under the new system, and listen to what they say. And they, some of them are incumbents who say, you know, before, if I was in a tight race, I'd go back to all my wealthy contributors and say, I need your help, and then I'd put out another mailing. Now, because I have a limited budget, I have to live within that budget, I have to go back to my community volunteers and ask more for them. And so you have people going back to the people in their community when they're in a tight race. Or new candidates who said, when I thought about running, the part that didn't appeal to me was going around and having to ask every special interest for a handout. But now I don't have to do that. So I'm running under this new system feeling that I'm not compromised. I don't have to choose between my constituents and my contributors anymore. I just owe my constituents.
Hmm. Well, we're just about at the midpoint of the show here, and I think at this point we will see if we can hook up with our second guest, William McNary. So, Mr. Neihardt, if you'll just hang on there, we'll put you on hold, and we'll put in the call to guest number two. We'll get the conference call set up, and then we'll also get a bit of a perspective here for you on what's happening on this issue that is campaign finance reform here in the state of Illinois. It's something that certainly here on this program we've talked about from time to time, and it had been some time, so we thought it would be a good idea to touch bases with the topic once again. And perhaps here again I will introduce the guest that we have been talking to, Nick Neihardt. He is the co-founder and the present executive director of Public Campaign. It's an organization based in Washington, D.C. It's been around for 3 years. It is a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization that is interested in campaign finance reform, and particularly the kind of approach which he has just outlined that we have seen, as he mentioned, implemented in a couple of states and then will be coming soon in the state of Massachusetts. He was the field director of public campaign in 1997 and 1998 and spent a lot of time working with people in the states of Arizona and Massachusetts on this particular issue. So he is in a position to talk a little bit about how that was organized and how we think that that would be working. So, and of course, we'll have more from him in just a moment, and we'll be certainly welcoming anybody who has questions, comments, who would like to give us a call. The numbers, as usual, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. It works for Illinois, for Indiana, in fact, for any state where that signal will travel. That's 800-222-WILL, 333-WILL here locally in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. And here we're still working here. I'm sure in a moment or two we'll get set up with our second guest for the hour, William McNary. He's the co-director of Citizen Action Illinois, which is this state's largest public interest organization. They have something like 23,000 individual members, as well as many affiliated state organizations. They've been around since 1975 and are interested in several different issues, including energy and health care, but certainly campaign finance reform is one of them. It's an organization that has gone through a couple of name changes, was once known as the Illinois Public Action Council, IPAC. You might recall that. But essentially, even though the name has changed, it's the same kind of organization. We're continuing to work on seeing if we can get our, and it looks like maybe we're not going to be able to talk with William McNary. So what we'll do is we'll continue talking with our guest, Nick Neihardt, and our director here, Brian Wagner, says he is going to keep trying to see if he can get a hold of Mr. McNary. And if not, of course, we can just continue with the topic and with the guest that we started with, Nick Neihardt. He is executive director of the group Public Campaign based in Washington, D.C. And again, if you'd like to call in here and ask questions, make comments, that's certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we do have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-WILL or 9455. Well, Mr. Neihardt, I guess we'll stay with you for a while, and
okay,
then we'll continue and see if a little bit later we can find Mr. McNary. We'll get him on there, too. One of the issues that has come up when we talk about the cost of campaigns is the cost of television time. Candidates spend a lot of money buying time on TV to run their ads. And I think some people have argued that that's a problem, and if somehow television broadcasters could be persuaded to provide that time for free or at a reduced cost, it would make a big difference in what campaigns cost. Now, I suppose some people might argue that the candidates would simply find some other way to spend the money. That wouldn't necessarily mean they would be spending less, and the commercial broadcasters say, well, that's not exactly fair to us, expecting us to foot the cost of campaigns.
Right.
But having said all that, do you think that it would make a significant difference at all if we could do something about the cost of television time for candidates?
It would certainly make a difference. And in fact, as part of a package of fully publicly financed elections, it would be wise at the federal level to ask broadcasters, who after all don't own the airwaves, they're loaned or leased or rented them by the public, to kick back to us some of that time for the public's benefit. I know they view it as public financing solely at their expense, and I think one could look at a balance, but let's remember that the public airwaves are public. So as part of a package, it makes sense. I think we need to, on the other hand, not hand out a public good like public financing or public airwaves to candidates who are already indebted to special interests. In other words, if you have to raise 75 or 80 or 90% of your money the old-fashioned way from the lobbyists and the wealthy contributors, so you owe them and you have to go through that process to get this benefit, I don't think that's the best deal for the public. And that's why we've supported a full public financing system rather than just adding in a few resources. Ultimately, to get candidates out of the money chase, you have to have the full package of resources, money that candidates can spend on other needs as well. It's also important to remember that while television is very important for the national race for president or U.S. Senate races and in many congressional races, in other races, smaller races that aren't statewide, races for state legislature, direct mail, radio, other kinds of forms of communication are more important, and there are other campaign expenses too. So while broadcasting time is an important component of a clean money type system, in and of itself, it can't solve the problem.
We have another caller here in southeastern Illinois to bring into the conversation. It's line number 4. Hello?
Yes, television was one of the things that I was going to call in about and strange. Started it. Do you have any idea what percentage of campaign costs are paid television?
Sure. There was a study done several years ago. There have been a lot of studies on where the money comes from for elections, but fewer on where the money gets spent. And a study a number of years ago showed for federal elections, the amount of money spent on television was between 20 and 25% of a campaign budget. Now, that varies from race to race, and that was the standard overall for Congress. But the point here is that while it's a big expense, there are other big expenses as well. For instance, fundraising costs about the same, around 20% of every candidate dollar spent.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
God, that...
The cost of raising the money is huge. Now, these figures are from the mid-90s, so they may be a bit out of date.
Well, where would there be such a terrible expense in fundraising? I mean, direct mail things, you mean? I mean,
direct mail is one part of that, but when you host a big event, you've got to pay the costs. You're going to have fundraisers on staff. Often people hire very well-paid consultants to do this kind of fundraising. So the cost of fundraising can be a big part of campaigns.
So
in direct mail, for instance, if you're doing well, you might have to put out $5 for every $10 you bring back in.
Hmm. Well, then that would be kind of a loser. I mean, you know, wouldn't that be something that sheer business math would cause you not to do it if you're going to
well, but except if you're raising 10 bucks for every 5 you put out and you need that net 5.
Oh, I'm sorry, you said 10 for every 5. I
missed up, but what I mean is that direct mail is a relatively expensive form of fundraising. It allows you to do other things. You can express a lot about your candidacy in that mail and get your supporters more excited, but it's relatively expensive. And those big soirees they host also cost some money. So fundraising is a part of every candidate's budget.
Would it be possible to put, I don't know, suppose it would be, but I mean, would it be possible to put a limitation on what a candidate could, the ways a candidate could spend campaign money? I mean, if these soirees cost so much money, do they really get that much more from the individuals than they would get from sympathetic individuals anyway?
Well, you know, I think each candidate looks at that and makes their own judgment, and they certainly hire their campaign consultants and their fundraisers by who can bring back the most money overall.
What's your feeling on out-of-state money?
Well, again, I think any time a candidate is indebted to people other than their home constituents, there's a problem. If a candidate is in debt to people outside their districts, that adds an extra layer of accountability that really shouldn't be there. But even if you limited people to private money inside their districts, you still have a problem because you're probably more indebted to the group of people who can give you $1,000 than to the group of people who can only afford $25 or not afford any contribution at all. So we'd like to get away from a system where people are owe their private contributors. And because that means even if you're restricted to folks in the district, you owe some people more than others.
Now, let's say there was a complete, you get what you want, what you think ought to be done.
Pardon me?
Suppose that you get the program, the laws passed that you feel
that's right.
Ought to be passed in this thing. What would that do to individuals running ads on their own or groups of individuals running ads on their own promoting one candidate or another? without even ever going through the candidate himself?
That's an important question. Under our system, candidates who are running under the clean money system, if they are attacked by an independent expenditure from an outside group or a friend of the opposing candidate, they get a match to respond to that ad. So they get essentially more speech and allow the voters more information, so you don't have a one-sided playing field.
Suppose they're praised.
Pardon me?
Suppose they are praised. Does the other side get...
If they are praised, if, in other words, if the independent expenditure supports the clean money candidate and their opposition is also clean money, the clean money opponent also gets matching funds. Again, the goal here is to keep a level playing field and have a discourse that is relatively even, with each side getting to say what it wants to say and needs to say, and let the voters decide on the basis of a more equal campaign debate.
Okay, one final question. I'll give somebody else a chance. What does this do to non-incumbents and versus incumbents, and what is does this do to minor candidates, Nader or like Nader or
Sure, Buchanan.
Let
me take the first question first because it's very important. The biggest disadvantage the challengers have is that they can't raise the money. If you're an incumbent, you have access to all those people, the lobbyists and others that you've done favors for, and they or you hold their policies in your hand when you're voting, so they have a reason to do business with you. And a challenger rarely has access to that kind of money. Certainly, most ordinary people don't. So, by offering people another way to run competitively with the public financing, you'll see challengers with the money to get their message out, and that's going to change politics in so many races right now. Actually, in Massachusetts, where they passed this law, 70% of the state legislative races, there's only one major party candidate because the other side is a major reason for not running is he can't raise the money. So we expect when the Massachusetts law goes into effect, voters will have a chance to choose between two candidates. Now, in terms of minor party candidates, there's sort of a sliding scale. And once a candidate or that party has demonstrated a measure of success, they can qualify people under that party banner for the public financing. And independent, and once you're at 20%, your party's getting 20% of the polls, party candidates can qualify for the exact same amount. Independent candidates have some hurdles to go through to qualify, a slightly higher qualifying threshold, but they also get funding under this system. So again, we're trying to give voters more choices and more candidates the opportunity to run.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, our guest is Nick Neihardt. He is the co-founder, and also the present executive director of Public Campaign. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization based in Washington, D.C. that's interested in campaign finance reform and in the particular kind of reform here that we've talked about with the kind of model being the kind of reforms that have been enacted in states of Maine, Vermont, and Arizona, and will go into effect in Massachusetts in a couple of years. Questions welcome. We have other people here ready and waiting. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Someone here from a call from a car phone, so we'll go to line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a question and a comment, if I might. My question is, once you get all this money out of the campaigns, isn't it really like just spraying for insects? I mean, won't the money run somewhere else and there be surrogates out there doing the same job?
That's a good question. We don't pretend that you can get rid of all the money in politics or that you can eliminate the influence of special interests. But under this kind of a system, you at least give candidates the chance to run, the option of running without the special interest money. And that in and of itself is going to change politics. You're right. There's still going to be money trying to affect any system, and you can back the money off. In fact, in this case, we're backing it off from the candidates and allowing the most essential vehicle of democracy. That's the candidates themselves, or I suppose after the voters, they're the most essential, allow them to communicate with voters without having to be indebted to contributors. So you can't get all the money out of politics. That's not the goal, but at least you can give candidates the chance to run without having to go through that horrific money chase that takes you to the special interest pots of money if you want to be a candidate.
Well, my thought would be, however, that this type of arrangement might be viewed as benefiting certain other organizations that are in force and have certain views and that are very large. For example, if the money chase is out to the organizations, then organizations like AARP or the Teachers Association or any other big association, no matter what their political view, are going to all of a sudden obtain very large political clout, even larger than they have right now. And that might favor one side or the other.
That's right. I do expect that if you limit money, or you begin, people will look for other ways. And under this system, I think you're right, that it will encourage people to try to influence individual people and mobilize members. And it certainly plays to the advantage of groups with grassroots strength. And those could be groups like the NRA, or it could be a labor union, or lots of different kind of groups. But isn't that what we want? Don't we want to turn people back to a grassroots system? It'll encourage the parties, rather than becoming the political parties, rather than becoming sort of check mail drops, right? They're just money mail drops right now. It'll encourage them to actually go back and try and mobilize people at the grassroots level. And so we'll have a people-oriented politics instead of a money-oriented politics. So I think there's a good point that you're raising, but that means the race is about people. And in democracy, people ought to be what counts, not money.
But haven't people already done that? Haven't people already joined a political party? That's the issue. You could argue that is a grassroots organization.
Well, except that, you know, what I see in my own home state here in Connecticut, and what I've seen or what I've heard from so many other people, the parties are both withering at the grassroots level. And what the parties are mostly about now is raising money from wealthy contributors. So if you try and hold that even, and the parties see a greater strength, like, well, we're not about raising money now. What we're really about is mobilizing people to grassroots. That's going to force the parties to pay attention to the activists at the grassroots level in the neighborhoods, in the people with their community networks, rather than how many wealthy donors can we get to write us a check today. And that would be a healthy thing for our system.
Right. My comment was, sir, that the question was brought up about the advantage of incumbents. I agree that they would have the same amount of money as a challenger, but don't you see an intrinsic built-in advantage to incumbents that doesn't have anything to do with money because of just the normal TV and media exposure that an incumbent can get that's going to overwhelm any challenger?
I think it is the biggest advantage is in the incumbent's ability to raise money, and sometimes that publicity you're talking about can be a negative. I will add that in Vermont, when they passed this law in the legislature there, they actually gave the challengers a little bit more money than the incumbent to account for that. But I think if you look at Maine, where there are 116 candidates now running under this new system, there were 40% more primaries this year. So clearly challengers, this is encouraging to challengers. And we'll see how it all plays out. But right now, this is a much better deal for challengers, and it helps level the playing field. I agree there are certain incumbent advantages. There are certain disadvantages, too, which you actually have to take stands on issues, and you have a record you got to run on. So for better or for worse, the incumbent is in a different situation.
We're at the point here. We have maybe about 3-4 minutes left, and I have other callers I'd like to try to include. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Yes, since time is running out and you have not made contact with your Illinois guest, I wonder if your present guest, who has a kind of a national overview of things, could comment upon any things that might be going on in Illinois these days on this subject. Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Okay.
All right. I know that there's a broad coalition that includes the League of Women Voters, that includes Mr. McNary's group, Citizen Action. It includes a lot of other Common Cause and other groups sort of all over the map that care about reform. And they've been able to push forward some legislation. I think it was either a gift ban or increased disclosure. And they're working for broader changes. There was a clean money bill that's been offered a couple years in a row, first by Representative Schakowsky, who's now in Congress. And so the issue has been broached and brought before the legislature. I do know that Illinois has some of the widest open laws in the country as far as not having campaign limits, so there's lots to be done. But there's a very solid coalition that is trying to make progress on it. I think that these systems that are working well now this first time out in Maine and Arizona and Vermont, soon in Massachusetts, I think we're going to be able to see those candidates who've been through that system come to states like Illinois and talk to their peers, the other legislators, and say, you know, we went to this system, and it's a big improvement. Let me tell you how. And so a lot of people don't want to be first and don't want to try and make change till it's worked elsewhere. And hopefully some of these other victories that have happened for reform are going to influence states like Illinois. I mentioned Missouri there because a clean money system is on the ballot in Missouri and on in Oregon this fall. Perhaps a victory in a neighboring state like Missouri will show folks that there's a different way of doing this sort of right over the border, and that will have some influence. Again, if you look to change in Washington, you're not going to see the kinds of changes we need, but it's happening at the state level, and hopefully that will influence and give courage to legislators in Illinois about having a change system.
One more caller here, Oakwood, line 3. Hello?
I haven't heard all the program, but I have mainly a comment, and that even for the non-incumbents trying to get elected or at least getting their message out there, the incumbents waste a horrible amount of the public's time just trying to raise money, and so if we could get rid of a lot of the money, they could spend more of their time on what they're really being paid to do in Washington or wherever, instead of having to constantly waste so much of their time on doing other things. That's just my comment.
Okay, well,
very good point.
Not my heart. You want to take that any further?
Well, I agree totally. I was called this fall by a candidate for Congress in Rhode Island, a friend of a friend, who said, you know, this person said you might be supportive of me. And I asked her how many, she was a challenger for an open seat, and I asked her how many hours a day are you spending making phone calls? And she said, oh, I'm doing really well. I'm spending 8 hours a day on the phone. So here she is calling me from out of, you know, not in her state of Rhode Island, spending 8 hours a day not talking to voters, but talking to out-of-state people, trying to pull together enough money so she could be competitive. Now, that's a terrible waste of time and a disservice to the voters. But that is the system. Unless you have your own money and can write yourself a check like John Corzine or Ross Perot or Stephen Forbes, that's what you're forced to do. And that's a crazy way to run elections.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sorry that we were not able to connect with Bill McNary, co-director of Citizen Action Illinois, but I am sure that we will be talking about this subject again on future programs, and perhaps we can have him there. And for the moment, we also want to say to our guest, Nick Neihardt, executive director of Public Campaign in Washington, Mr. Neihardt, thank you very much for talking
with
us. We appreciate it.
Bye-bye.